Scott here with another episode of the History Unplugged podcast. Emigration probably never happened on a more massive scale than the outflow from Ireland during the 19th and 20th centuries. Between 1821 and 1901, around 6 million men and women moved permanently to another country. By 1961, another 2 million followed. By the end of the 19th century, 2 out of every 5 people born on the island were living beyond its shores. Many in the United States disliked the Irish when they arrived, not allowing them to have certain jobs, forming political groups like the Know-Nothing Party to keep them out of higher levels of American society, but because the Irish provided an essential source of cheap labor that fueled industrialization, they became a dominant group in labor movements and urban politics. Irish culture spread and it became commodified, leading to the universalization of the Irish pub and Guinness, and annual St. Patrick's Days in cities throughout the world. To talk about the global impact of Ireland is today's guest, Sean Connolly, author of the new book on Every Tide, The Making and Remaking of the Irish World. We talk about the social and political impact of Irish immigrants. In addition to spreading the Catholic Church, the Irish were also a dominant reform group, and how the story of Irish immigration can help contextualize the current migrant crisis, because Irish settlers often face similar hostilities to what immigrants experience today. This discussion adds a lot of context and nuance to a story that many of us know well, potato famine, and takes it much deeper. I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Sean Connolly. And one more thing before we get started with this episode, a quick break for a word from our sponsors. I think befitting a history of the Irish people, your book doesn't start with facts or data, but with a story or two stories. These stories involve two figures, Gerald O'Hara and Patrick Duroc. Who are these people and what do you think their stories say about most people's views of the Irish immigrant experience?
Well, I picked these two. One is fictional. Gerald O'Hara is, of course, the father of Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. Patrick Duroc is a central character in a lightly fictionalized account of the Duroc family, which is regarded as a classic of the making of Australia. I picked them because they tell two very similar stories of an Irish immigrant who arrives with nothing, who achieves great success, driven from the very beginning by a particular mindset, which is associated with memories of historical grievance and a desperate desire to make good. The reason I did this is because what led me to write the book in the first place, the question I had in mind was, why are the Irish so prominent in the world stage? Yes, they emigrate, but we're talking about something like 8 million people emigrating across a period of about a century and a half. In the great movements of people to take place in the 19th, 20th century, that's a drop in the ocean. And yet the Irish become very prominent in the culture of the societies in which they settle. And right up to today, Ireland has a soft power far above what's merited by its size or important on the world stage, which has its roots in this diaspora.
We're going to take what to many people is a familiar story of the mass emigration out of Ireland in the 1840s to the United States, to other places, and add more context around it. But before that, I think it's worth running down some of the facts about Ireland's history that you think listeners need to know to make sense of the story. So could you tell us about these things, Ireland's history itself, its conflict with the English, the potato famine, etc.?
Well, I mean, that is a tricky one because it leads you to make all sorts of judgments about how you interpret Irish emigration and the Irish diaspora. I mean, conventionally, people describe emigration in terms of push and pull, people being pushed out of their homeland by unendurable circumstances and pulled by the prospect of better opportunities elsewhere. And if you talk about Irish politics, about Ireland's status as uneasily ruled by Great Britain, as an uneasy part of the United Kingdom, that tends to load the dice in favor of push rather than pull. Now, there are periods when people emigrating from Ireland are fleeing from unendurable circumstances, notably the Great Famine of 1845 to 51 and a few years afterwards, even something like 2 million people emigrate, and many of them are in fact fleeing from fever and the prospect of starvation. But the other side of the story is that what you have in Ireland is a poor society, which is right next to and closely linked to a much richer, more advanced society, Great Britain. And so the paradox you get in early 19th century Ireland in, say, the 1820s, 1830s, you know, well before the famine, this is not an economy on the point of collapse. But because it's linked to Great Britain, it has all the infrastructure of an advanced early 19th century society. Roads, canals, mass education, relatively high levels of literacy, constant shipping moving back and forth from ports. You know, totally in contrast to poorer regions of continental Europe, like southern Italy, which have none of those things. So it's not that surprising that when people in a society like this are discontented, that they're highly aware of the opportunities elsewhere. So emigration from Ireland, mass emigration, gets underway in the 1820s and 30s. It's not yet a flight from economic collapse. It's people seeing opportunities elsewhere which are not available to them at home. And similarly, after the famine, from the late 1850s onwards, people, Irish society is actually becoming more prosperous. Living standards are rising, but people still leave because by this time, because of the huge emigration that's already taken place, there is a large Irish population overseas, notably in the United States. Any young man or woman, virtually in the 1860s, 1870s, who doesn't see many prospects at home, has a cousin or an uncle or a relative of some kind or a former neighbor or a former school friend in the United States. Emigration has become easy. So certainly there is a tragic dimension to the Irish diaspora, particularly during the period of the famine, but there is also simply a society where, because of Ireland's particular circumstances, people are highly aware of opportunities elsewhere and travel out of the country is not that difficult.
You make an interesting point that the mass immigration of the potato famine is possible in the 1840s in a way that it may not have been possible at other time periods. For example, if this famine had happened a century earlier, people would have simply starved at home. But because of what's happening in the 1840s due to massive needs for manpower and the winding down of slavery, there's an open window here that's different in times before and after it. Can you describe this more?
Actually, you're absolutely right there, because as it happens, there was a serious crop failure in 1741, which did in fact kill off about 1 in 8 of the population. And there is no corresponding rise of emigration. And this is because you're looking in from the early 19th century onwards at a new world. It's the great era of industrialization. Now, when people think of industrialization, they think of machines, steam engines. But you've got to remember just how little or how specialized the work a steam engine will do. A steam engine can drive a ship across the ocean, but somebody has to build that ship. And in this era, it is still manual work done with sledgehammers and rivets. Steam can drive a railway engine across a territory. Somebody has to lay the railway track. And as population rises, as great industrial cities grow, those cities have to be built brick by brick, house by house, street by street. All this requires massive labor with pick and shovel and wheelbarrow. So in the era of industrialization, the rise of a new interconnected international economy, and of course, the opening up of new lands for European settlement, you need huge amounts of manpower. And you're absolutely right. In the past, that would have been done by slavery. I mean, for example, in the American South, the great expansion of cotton planting from the coastal areas inland that takes place because of technological change from the 1790s onwards is done with slaves. It's slaves who undertake the grueling manual work of clearing shrub and forest and breaking up ground for cultivation. But slavery is on the way out. The British Empire has abolished the slave trade in 1807. It abolishes slavery in its own colonies in 1833. United States finally gives up slavery in 1865. Brazil abandoned slavery in the 1880s. So slavery is no longer an option. Instead, what you get is an international trade in people. And what's unique about this is not movement overseas. People have been going overseas for centuries. But generally speaking, what you've got is people from rich, powerful societies entering the lands of weaker, more vulnerable civilizations and taking them over, like the Spanish, for example, in South and Central America. This is different. This is rich countries like the United States importing cheap labor from poorer countries. And it starts with the Irish, but of course, later from the 1880s, you're getting growing numbers from Eastern and Southern Europe as railways are built, as ports are developed, as these areas gradually come into closer contact with the outside world, they become sources of the same sort of cheap labor.
That aspect of, let's say, an underclass immigrating being something new, I'd really like to explore the social aspect of this and the sort of tensions that arise in the United States, but also other nations where the Irish arrive, because poorer laborers have always immigrated in indentured servant class, were often poor people in the 17th century, but they were a small number and a trickle, and they, whatever background they had, they would more or less assimilate into the society they came into. But with the Irish experience, you have so many people arriving that it's possible in a certain way to keep your home culture intact. You're also bringing a different form of Christianity. This overwhelms some people. This leads to political parties that are set up in opposition to this spike in Roman Catholicism, such as the Know Nothing Party in Massachusetts. I did a whole episode on the development of public education in the United States, and much of it was in response to this spike and a fear that the growth of private Catholic schools could threaten the Protestant nature of the United States. Although it took 120 years from this period to actually have a Catholic president. So I suppose that says that if you have an establishment that doesn't want a certain person in, the establishment is very good at keeping that person out. But can you describe some of the friction of Irish immigration in the societies in which they arrived?
Yes, the Irish, when they arrive, are economically necessary, but they're not welcome. The Native American working class are not at all keen because they fear that these cheap incomers will undercut them and drive down their wages. And the respectable classes are horrified by what they see as an underclass who are disorderly, who are fond of drink, and who, of course, are Catholics, which makes them suspect in American eyes. And this is part of a wider suspicion of immigration. It's not just the Irish who are targeted. There is a more general feeling that immigrants from old Europe are coming from a society which is still a society of aristocracy, of monarchy, of top-down autocratic government, and many of them being Catholics under the authority of the Pope. So how can they possibly fit into a democratic society? As soon as they arrive, they're able to vote, and the Irish are actually very quick to get themselves registered to vote. But can they possibly share the values of a democratic egalitarian republic? So there is a very strong anti-immigrant movement. It reaches its peak in the late 1840s, early 1850s, in what's known as the Know Nothing Movement. They called themselves the American Party, but reportedly members were under instructions, if anybody asked about the party, your answer was, I know nothing. So these were the Know Nothing Movement. And for a brief period in the early 1850s, they capture control of a number of state governments. They are well represented in Congress, and they are agitating for severe restrictions on the freedom of immigrants. Now, it's important to note they were not saying we must put an end to immigration, because for the reasons I've already mentioned, immigration is necessary. Somebody has to fill up these vacant lands. Somebody has to provide this labor. What they want instead is that immigrants should have to go through a long period of probation, 21 years, before they become eligible to vote or become citizens, and that only native-born Americans should hold political office or should be police, for example. So it is an expression of deep anxiety, a feeling that the core values of a democratic egalitarian republic will be undermined by these people who are coming from a totally different political culture.
Without jumping ahead too far, in public policy debates about immigration in the United States, I've heard a lot of comparisons to the experience of the Irish, mostly commentators noting that these fears about the Irish were stark at the time, but we've seen in hindsight they were unfounded and silly because people have immigrated seamlessly. You would never know anyone was of Irish background unless they mentioned it or they had maybe particularly bright red hair. But other than that, I can barely remember any time I've looked at someone and thought, oh, they must be of Irish background. And fears like that about 21st century concerns of immigration are equally unfounded. But without jumping ahead to modern day concerns too quickly, can you just describe the immigrant experience of Irish people? And maybe you can think of a few examples of what kind of prejudice did they face? And was this true across the board, or were many able to mostly integrate into, let's say, the American example, but we could also take Australia or other examples if you wish. So what do you make of this comparison?
Okay, I think a lot depends on where the immigrants go, in the sense that there's a lot of work now to show that the further west the Irish went in the United States, the better they did. The Irish arrived, for example, in San Francisco, just as it's becoming a boom town with the gold rush. So they arrive in a society where there isn't a social hierarchy. There's no established upper class drawing up the drawbridge behind them. And so it is much easier for the Irish to take their place at every level in the occupational structure. There are, for example, there's a lot more Irish people who are bankers and stockbrokers, for example, in San Francisco by the end of the 19th century than in somewhere like New York or Boston, simply because it's a more open society. The prejudice arises when the Irish arrive because so many of the Irish congregate in the cities of the East Coast, in Boston, in Philadelphia, in New York, and then in Midwestern giants like Chicago, where there is already, as I say, an established social hierarchy, and they tend to fit in at the bottom. And the circumstances of the first emigrants are, by any standards, grim. I mean, statistics suggest that, I mean, there's one astonishing statistic. It was suggested that the life expectancy of an Irish immigrant arriving in Boston in the 1850s was about 15 years. And that a combination of grueling manual work, living in overcrowded conditions, lack of medical attention, malnutrition, all just contribute to very high levels of mortality. So, I mean, the first Irish emigrants share the fate of emigrants right to the present day. They come in to do the work that nobody else is prepared to do, while at the same time being reviled and denounced as a threat to the core values of the society in which they've come to live. Now, this contrasts sharply with the experience of the Irish in what becomes Canada, or in Australia or New Zealand, because again, they're turning up in societies which are still fluid, which are still in the process of being constructed, and they do much better. In Ontario, for example, by the 1870s, the Irish, both Catholic and Protestant, are the region's most successful farmers. In Australia and New Zealand, in the late 19th century, they're distributed evenly across all levels of the social hierarchy. The first emigrants to East Coast United States, by contrast, do have a grim time. But by the end of the 19th century, conditions are improving. The second generation, in particular, begin to move into skilled or semi-skilled labor. And it's also the beginnings of a small Irish middle class. You can see how significant this is from the number of names people coin to describe the emerging Irish middle class. There's lace curtain Irish, of course, but people also talk about the two toilets Irish, the steam heat Irish, and my personal favorite was families that have fruit in the house, even when nobody's ill. So by the end of the 19th century, if you take the first generation, the immigrants and their sons and daughters together as an Irish population, their economic position is roughly the same as that of the American, white American population as a whole.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors. I've seen images online from the 19th century that will say, no Irish need apply or help wanted, whatever, no Irish, no dogs, things of that nature. The high water mark of tension for immigration is around the mid-19th century. And what would be sort of the sharpest form of discrimination that you've read? Simply that they couldn't get certain positions, or what did you see?
Yes, there is well-documented cases of discrimination against hiring the Irish for more desirable skilled jobs. Though, of course, what you've got to remember there is this isn't just the employing class. This is also the established American working class who, as I say, want to preserve jobs for their own sons and are not at all keen on these outsiders coming in and possibly being willing to work for lower wages. So even where an employer isn't out to discriminate, a workforce can make clear that they don't want a certain type of person working for them. You also get it in terms of the hiring of Irish women as domestic servants, where you get rubrics like, well, you get the blatant no Irish need apply. You also get things like German girl preferred or colored girl preferred or Protestant girl preferred, all ways of excluding what are seen as the undesirable Irish. But the point is, going back to what we said earlier, you need these people. You might want to discriminate against them. And in the case of the Irish domestic servant, for example, there's a whole stereotype of what they called Bridget, the Irish maid, who was slovenly and undisciplined and not very bright. A whole ethnic stereotyping. But the Irish, nevertheless, are the dominant group among domestic servants in the East Coast cities. Because at this point, they're the main immigrant group. and where there are other ethnic groups, like, for example, Spaniards or Italians or Eastern Europeans, most of them are men. And where there are women, their families are very reluctant to let them leave the house for any purpose other than getting married. And you haven't yet had the great migration of African Americans from the southern states to provide a workforce. So people complain endlessly about Irish maids, but they have no choice but to hire them. And it's also very clear from the literature that Irish maids know their worth, that they are very ready to change employers if they're not well treated. And in fact, a lot of the venom directed at the Irish maid is precisely because employers feel their helplessness, that they are in the power of these women they look down on, but desperately need to maintain their own leisured lifestyle.
There's an interesting point you make I would really like to explore. And that is when you mentioned earlier the drawbridge going up, that when the Irish entered fluid societies, they were able to find positions of power before those positions were harder to access. When they arrive in these fluid societies, but then these fluid societies become more rigid, sometimes these immigrants themselves can project the sorts of discrimination that themselves receive back in their homeland. So part of the Irish mythology is the occupation of the English and the discrimination they face in their own homeland. And then when they themselves go to the, say, the American frontier, they're talking about the superiority of the white race, or in Australia, they think about colonizing this new land and civilizing it from the barbarian races or the indigenous people that are there, forgetting their own homeland experience. Now, I don't say that to castigate them, but just maybe more explore the universal human impulse not to project onto others what they themselves had received, but not see any discrepancy. So can you explore that angle for me and help me to understand it?
Yeah, certainly. And I think you're absolutely right. There's no point in doing all this in a tone of moral condemnation. I mean, we just have to accept the 19th century is a period of European expansion onto the lands of other people and of the fairly ruthless repression of indigenous peoples in order to secure European control of those lands. And it is also inescapably a world of racial hierarchies. And therefore, there's no point in complaining people's attitudes weren't more like our own. But you are absolutely right. At every stage, the Irish are determined to defend their own interests, which in many cases means conflict with other groups. In the United States itself, for example, the Irish gain control of work on the docks, for example, by considerable violence directed against African-American competitors. The minority of Irish who travel, as you say, to frontier areas to the West show no compunction about the displacement of Native Americans to make way for their expansion. And they do make up a substantial part of the U.S. cavalry. About a quarter of U.S. cavalry in Western states were of Irish descent, engaged in the sharp end of conflict with Native Americans. Similarly, in Australia, there is a certain mythology about how the Irish were kinder to Aboriginal people in Australia than other ethnic groups. There's very little evidence for that. And in fact, because the Irish are so prominent once again in the police, they are again involved in the direct process of repressing Aboriginal Australians. The clearest example in many ways I found is in the case of the small Irish community in Argentina. It had its own newspaper, the Southern Cross. And Southern Cross, as a paper catering to Catholic nationalist population, regularly wrote about the injustices suffered by the people of Ireland as their land was seized by English colonizers. But the same paper also talked in glowing terms about the opportunities available for Irish migrants because of land that had now been rescued, as they put it, from barbarism and made available for civilized settlement. So at every stage, the story of the Irish is of conflict. In the late 19th century, you get quite vicious conflicts between the Irish and the newly arrived Italians, again, competing for work in construction projects. And the Irish also play a very prominent part in the anti-Chinese agitation in the Western states.
Right. Thank you for the clarification. And as a 21st century person, sometimes when it's easy to castigate a 19th century person for their uncouth language, I was reminded to keep in mind a few weeks ago when I was cutting down a tree and chopping it up into firewood with a chainsaw and getting tired after 2 hours that Not too long ago, somebody would have to clear acres of farmland with nothing but an axe, and that's what many of these laborers do. So they did this for 17 hours a day for years on end. So just keep that in mind when you think about that. They, you know, they have their own hardships along with, you know, what we think of as their uncouth ways. Well, as we move later into the 19th century, the story changes a bit from one of marginalization to the Irish people, at least in the United States, but also, I'm sure, elsewhere, of becoming central in different political movements, whether labor movements or urban politics. The machine politics of many cities in the United States, in New York, in Boston, in my hometown of Kansas City, the Irish are central to those political coalitions that keep these machine politicians in power, sometimes for decades. Can you talk about that part of the Irish immigrant experience?
I think the key point here is that, okay, the Irish arrive in the United States and elsewhere with very few marketable skills and with very little in the way of financial capital. But they do bring with them two great advantages. The first is that because they're emigrating within the Anglo sphere, they are familiar with the political institutions and the legal systems that they're going to encounter, because the United States system is obviously draws heavily on its English precedents. So they're dealing with familiar institutions. And what you've got to remember there is just how differently structured the world of Europe was. Up to 1848, you're dealing with a Europe of absolute monarchies and totally different, heavily centralized autocratic states. And also, the Irish speak English. Even the ones who are Irish speakers, in most cases, would have some knowledge of English. And that gives them a huge advantage. So by the second half of the 19th century, the Irish have carved out a position for themselves in the middle levels of American society. Notably, as you say, in municipal politics, where they control a great many of the great political machines. And also in the labor movement, where again, their experience of political organization and their command of English makes them natural leaders in working class agitation. And of course, everywhere in the English-speaking world, in the Catholic Church. I mean, by 1900, nearly two-thirds of American bishops are either born in Ireland or of Irish descent. And that's because there are German Catholics, there are French Catholics, but the Vatican pragmatically realizes if you want the Catholic Church to spread in North America or in Australia or New Zealand, it needs to be led by native English speakers. So the Irish, who become the natural candidates for leadership. So in that sense, the Irish might still not be available in the golf clubs, private members clubs of the WASP elite, but they have a very strong position somewhat lower down in the structures of power in American society.
Looking at the commodification of Irish culture, when does this happen? Because you mentioned that Ireland as a nation punches above its weight culturally in terms of how many people it has. So I've seen Irish pubs in Istanbul, Turkey, and parts of Southeast Asia, whereas you probably wouldn't see, you know, most restaurants with cuisine from, say, Burkina Faso, even though they might have similar population numbers. So with the commodification of Irish culture, is this something in the mid-20th century? Does it happen earlier? What does this process look like?
I think it is something which takes place, yes, in the second half of the 20th century. And it has a number of roots. I mean, part of it, of course, is simply the deep cultural footprint that the Irish have left. There have been so many Irish immigrants, and they begin coming so early. They are a prominent part of the culture of the societies in which they've settled. But also, what you're looking at, I think, is the fact that Irish culture is particularly suited to benefit from the great revival of interest in ethnic culture and folk culture that you get in the period after the Second World War. I mean, this is an era in which a lot of people are becoming tired of what they see as the bland uniformity of a consumer culture. They're looking for something different. But the problem with ethnic cultures is they can be very strange and very alien. Whereas what Ireland offers is what is clearly a distinct ethnic culture rooted in a colorful history, but it's also accessible because it's accessible through the English language and its cultural forms are not that strange. I mean, the first big breakthrough is the group, the Clancy brothers with their associate Tommy Makem, who made their big breakthrough on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1961 in their trademark Aran sweaters. But the point you have to remember here is that for several years before that, this group had been honing their craft in Greenwich Village on stages alongside performers like Pete Seeger and the young Joan Baez. What they're offering is rooted in Irish song culture, but it is adapted to the wider folk revival of the 1960s. So you then get a further development from the late 1970s, what has been called the Roots 2 movement, where partly in response to the great flowering of interest in African-American culture roots following Alex Haley's massive worldwide bestseller, you start to get other ethnic groups insisting that they have roots as well. And then in the 1990s, you're into the years of the Celtic Tiger, when Ireland's spectacular economic success gives a further glamour to the international image of Irishness. And that's when you get, for example, Riverdance, which takes the very distinctive tradition of Irish dance, but turns it into a spectacle, very cleverly attuned to the demands of the MTV age. And as you say, the Irish pub, which is now found, throughout the world. What is striking about all of this is that this is an international image of Irishness, but it's taking place at a time when the Irish diaspora is receding into the past. I mean, mass migration from Ireland continues right up to the 1960s, but from the time of the Great Depression onwards, emigration to the United States falls to a much lower level. Emigration to Australia and New Zealand has already largely collapsed because of recession in those countries. The great majority of Irish emigrants from the 1930s onwards go no further than Great Britain, England, Scotland, and Wales. So this cultural revival is taking place at a time when actual dispersal of Irish people around the world has largely come to an end. And the Irish culture that is being presented is in many ways very different to the culture of the Irish diaspora. And the great majority of Irish emigrants in, say, the high point of the Irish diaspora in the late 19th, early 20th century were piously Catholic, socially conservative. Whereas what image of Irishness is presented by the Irish pub, for example? It's of a secular, cheerful, laid-back Ireland, at ease with itself and its interactions with the outside world, a sort of glamorous, secular sort of hedonism, many times removed from the culture of the ordinary men and women who made up the Irish diaspora. And it reflects a changing Ireland. If you were to take the founders of the Irish state, people like Patrick Pearse, executed in 1916, and tell him that the modern symbol of the Ireland he'd helped to create was a pub, he would have been horrified.
Scott here. One more break for a word from our sponsors. I'm curious about the evolution of Ireland, which you mentioned after mass migration ends in 1920, when it transitions from a conservative religious society to a more socially liberal and secular country. When you look at other European nations that had overseas colonies, the effect that it has on those nations is sort of like a tide going out and then coming back in, where people from the United Kingdom or France or elsewhere, or Spain, go out to these different colonies and send their people there. What we've seen from the mid-20th century onward is that people from those colonies have come back. So you see Indian and Pakistani populations in the UK today. You see people from Algeria and France, etc. Ireland didn't have colonies, but it sent out lots of people. What effect would you say sending out such a large diaspora had on the motherland? One example I think of is, I've read accounts about somebody asked Irish people, what do you think when an American tourist comes and they mention that they're Irish because their great-great-great-grandfather came in 1840 and they're maybe 1/16th Irish. And I think I have maybe 12.5% Irish ancestry, but I realize that culturally that's completely meaningless. I have no connection to it whatsoever. There's nothing about Irish culture that impacts me today and my interests or tastes or whatever. So I realize that whatever connection I have is purely incidental. And if I took an ancestry.com test, I may find that I actually have no connection. So it's almost completely imaginary, but that's only anecdotal and my experience. Broadly speaking, what would you say is the diaspora's influence on Ireland today?
In the 19th, early 20th century, it was very strong because you had this massive emigration. And then what they call the emigrant remittance, the money people sent home, was actually vital to keeping huge numbers of poor rural families afloat. And there was a very strong direct personal connection. On the other hand, you got very little return migration. This, again, is the contrast between the Irish and other ethnic groups. Anything from a quarter to two-fifths of emigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe spent some years in the United States and then returned home with some money. Irish return migration is well under 10%. The Irish, once they've gone, don't come back. And you can see that as evidence of how well they have done in the United States or of the fact that there's not a great deal to come back to, depending how you want to interpret it. After the 1920s, that direct connection with the wider diaspora obviously weakens in the sense that many people will have a brother or a sister who went to work in England, but fewer and fewer a relative who went to work in the United States because emigration has dropped to two very low levels. And then from the 1960s, Irish society itself changes. It abandons the sort of nationalist economics of trying to create a closed economic system behind tariff walls and opens itself up to inward investment, and you get a great surge of prosperity, climaxing with the spectacular economic growth of the 1990s, early 2000s. And at that point, I think contact between the new secular, self-consciously modernizing Ireland and in many ways traditionally minded Irish American population, that contact was greatly reduced. And you see this particularly in recent years when there has been some debate about allowing Irish citizens overseas to take part in the election of the Irish president, which was proposed as a way of recreating connections with the diaspora, but immediately raised objections in some quarters with people saying, well, are we going to open the door to lots of barstool Republicans in places like Boston electing Gerry Adams as president of Ireland? Gerry Adams being the then leader of Sinn Féin, very closely associated with the IRA. And I would see that sort of debate as evidence of just how far and the Irish diaspora had drifted apart and in what different directions.
I'd like to come back to something we mentioned early in this episode about the similarities and differences between Irish migration in the 19th century and the current migrant crisis. I've had the chance to be in one nation, the United States, that receives a number of immigrants, and in another one, Turkey, that sends a lot of migrants. In the Turkish case, it's to Europe. Now, the positive spin on immigration is that these are people who, I mean, maybe they may not speak the language, but they enrich it in different ways. They offer new forms of culture. They're going to assimilate as the Irish did. They're going to become bedrocks of the community. And in a century or two, you would laugh at the thought that you would ever think that would be a threat to the well-being of the nation. On the other side of things, maybe the most extreme example is with Turkish migrants to places such as Germany, where there are millions and millions of them. There are cases where there are, some would say, outright meddling of Turkey in the domestic politics of Germany, where the president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, will call on Turkish Germans to vote for particular German political parties that would be most beneficial to Turkey, and essentially meddling directly in the domestic politics of another nation by claiming the purported ethnic loyalties that he thinks he has sway over, and also religious loyalties. So, speaking to those different views about immigration, what do you think the Irish story can tell us today?
Now, I think it is always important not to be dogmatic about these things. If you're taking the past and saying, has it lessons for the present, you have to be, I think, very sensitive to the differences. I mean, it would be simplistic simply to say, well, look at the Irish, that immigration turned out all right, so what's all the fuss about? I mean, there are essential differences. One is that the Irish immigrants to the United States were white, which meant that race itself was not an issue. They were Christian, even if Catholic. And they were arriving at a time when there was a generally agreed need for more people to fill up empty lands, so that notions that society is full, we can't take any more people, didn't have much purchase. So in all those ways, we're looking at different situations. What I would say is, and the point you've already hinted at, that looking at the Irish case, you can't draw direct parallels, but there is an eerie similarity between the charges being made about, like you say, Turkish immigrants in Europe and about Irish immigrants in 1840s and 50s America. Can these people be trusted with the vote, or will they be voting at the behest of a foreign potentate, Pope then, Erdogan now, that these people have a different culture, they will never assimilate, and so on. So you get a lot of the same rhetoric. People today talk about the threatened great transformation when white populations will be overwhelmed by immigrants and when Islam will replace Christianity as the dominant religion. People in the 1850s and 60s fantasize in the same way, that the American Republic would be overthrown and replaced by a Catholic monarchy on the European model. So there are lots of parallels, and I think it at least leads us to be aware of how easy it is to stereotype minorities and to get carried away by negative depictions of this kind. Beyond that, I mean, the other point which was very much struck me as I was doing the research, a lot of the debate about immigration, which you get today, focuses on the supposed distinction between refugees, people who are fleeing impossible conditions at home, and what are called economic migrants, people who just, whose lives are not under threat, but who just want a better life. And it struck me very much working on 19th century Ireland, the second half of the 19th century particularly, once the famine is over, that how difficult it is to maintain this distinction. If you look at it this way, in the second half of the 19th century, when the famine is in the past, people who chose not to emigrate were not going to starve. But they were living in a society with very strict rules of succession, where the family farm would be passed on to one son. One daughter would get a dowry that allowed her to marry into another farming household. Now, the other sons and daughters could stay on. I'll say they would not starve, but they would spend their lives as what were called assisting relatives, bachelor uncles or spinster aunts, helping out on the family farm in exchange for a seat around the dinner table and a little pocket money every now and then. In a society where there was very little work off the land, if you didn't inherit the family farm or didn't get a dowry, your only chance of being an independent adult with a home and a family of your own was to emigrate. So these people would not have starved, but neither would they have become what we would see as fully mature, independent adults. So does that make them economic migrants? Or do we say that, like so many migrants today, emigration is their only hope of having a proper life?
Well, this adds a lot of context and nuance and color to a story that is well known, but not well understood. And I really like delving into issues like this. There are many more things we couldn't get to in this discussion, but for listeners who want to check out the story, the name of Sean's book is On Every Tide, The Making and Remaking of the Irish World. Sean, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, that is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.